Hello and welcome to Differential Discussions. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Dave. And
And
I'm Josh.
today we have a guest with us, Josh, and he's going to basically ask us about our profession. So, Josh, you want to tell us just a little bit about you?
So I'm 17. I'm a going into senior year in high school right now. I'm interested in like math and engineering sort of, but pretty broad interest. This is sort of like classic like nerd interest, math, computer science, engineering, all that stuff. And I don't know very much about like life science and stuff like that, but I'm here to talk to you guys about what you do and how it's relevant to someone like me.
Perfect. So that's what this video and podcast is going to be, a little bit different than usual. Usual, we talk about lab things that would interest lab people. This one is going to be specifically targeted for people who are thinking about coming into college and what profession they should go into. So we're going to talk about what is med lab science. So, Josh, we're going to let you kind of steer the ship today.
All right. So if you guys like hypothetically, say you're at like some you're meeting like in-laws or something, or you're see someone on the street and they just ask you, what do you do? What is your like classic response for that? What do you say?
Excellent question. So my quick elevator speech is usually to direct people to common experience. So like I think I usually start with, well, you know when you get your blood drawn, right? And so we start there. Most people have had phlebotomy performed on them before. And then I tell them, the blood just kind of disappears into the ether. Well, it goes to a room full of Daves and Melissas, and we use various instruments to generate data for frontline clinicians. I think that's usually the more or less my gist for what we do. How do you approach it, Melissa?
I think that's one way. And then I think once COVID happened, then we would start saying things more like, well, COVID testing, we're the ones who perform the COVID testing. So we perform not your point of care tests, which are like the little kits you have at home to do your own testing, but we perform the more complex, mature, the more in-depth tests that would actually give you more accurate results than what those little test kits would give you. So we're the ones who perform those sorts of tests.
So that's a similar strategy, right? Like everyone by this point has had COVID like twice, three times. I don't even know, right? And everybody's had like COVID tests. So yeah, it's a great
Trying to
question.
draw that similar experience, trying to draw you. I see that.
Yeah.
So gonna jump around a little bit because I don't know if it'll be a consistent stream here. But so as someone in like high school, like classic like biology class and like stuff like that, and another like in math classes and stuff, it's very much feels kind of arbitrary and not super useful. How much of actual like anything in high school is at all useful compared to when you eventually get to college?
You're the MVP, Josh. I'm pumped. I don't know, Melissa, you want to start?
Yeah, so a lot of the general chemistry is going to be really helpful because you have to take gen chem, organic chem, and then clinical chem when you're in medical lab science in college. So chemistry is really helpful. Biology is really helpful as well, in that you're going to take more focused classes on human physiology and pathophysiology, so normal and abnormal functioning. But what happens is you have to have that general understanding of like the cell function, the what does the mitochondria do? You think you're never going to need to know that, the mitochondria is a powerhouse of the cell, but it actually becomes important when you get to human disease because, well, if the mitochondria is malfunctioning, this, if the nucleus is malfunctioning, that. So that actually does become quite an important foundational piece for med lab science in college. Math is very helpful because we do a lot of what we call lab math. We do a lot of dilutions, we do a lot of concentrations, solutions, those sorts of things in the laboratory. We don't do calculus, so that's not quite as helpful for our profession.
He's happy
But
about that one.
yeah, right. But we do, well, Josh loves calculus, so that's
Couple
that's why
books
he's
over
going to
there.
He's going to be an engineer and be one of our problem solvers. So that's lovely.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good
Yep.
fit.
So that's my answer, Dave. What do you say?
Yeah, so I think so. Melissa's absolutely right. So depending on what your goals are in college, there will be sequences of classes that are pretty much prescribed to you on some level. And you'll need those tools in from high school to make it through those hurdles. So that is true. I'm gonna look a little deeper into your question and to say that somebody like me who, or in general, like someone has like chemistry in high school and then they do chemistry in college, and then they get a nice shiny degree and they leave those buildings never to return, right? So how practical is the use of like stoichiometry, like balancing chemistry equations and all that? And I think on a lot of levels, most of what you'll learn, you will not use. So I'm here. I'm going to be the adult that tells you the truth. What I will also say is that in life, depending on the path you take, so I'll speak as a laboratorian. There are different ways that you can do your career. You can be someone who punches the clock and does minimum. There are a lot of folks that choose to do that, and that's not a terrible thing. Okay. Or you could be an individual that takes pride in the work that you're doing and wants to do it extremely well. And so what I find is that if you're of the latter type, that a lot of the you're learning how to learn in high school and college, and like any skill that you use over and over again, learning evolves as you move through the ranks of classes and as classes pose different challenges to you. So a lot of it actually does come forward in the sense that you don't, if you do well and you practice skills, you don't have to relearn things as much. You more intuitively arrive at answers to problems that you encounter. And depending on your level of education and responsibility, post-college, there'll be some pretty complicated problems that come your way. Some that don't have like neat kind of prescribed solutions. So that is a fantastic question. I think this, I'd echo what Melissa said about math. We have to be able to do like ratio, multiplication, division, sort of like intuitively. We need to be able to move in between units. So units of measure. Sometimes it's just order of magnitude changes. So like we're working with microliters, so millionths of a liter to thousandths of a liter, right? So for some folks, that's kind of that might be kind of tricky. It's really helpful if you're able to do that intuitively. But I just that was a really great question. So college essentially is going to teach you really, really important skills for what you're going to do, especially when you're in the STEM fields. There'll be very, very specific things that you're programmed to do, programmed to learn. And but I would say most of it doesn't really come back. And so college ends up being representing that you're trainable, that at a certain level of complexity and learning, you were able to achieve that and you'll be able to do that going forward. And that's generally true, right? So if you asked me, if you gave me my first year college chemistry book and I had to do like review questions, I might look a little silly at first. But like it'll come back real fast, if that makes any sense. And but excellent question. I hope I answered it.
So just as like it seems like just the from what I've seen, that's a very stressful field of work. And especially if, like you said, you're that second kind of person that's like really proud of your work and trying to put everything in. What do you think is like the this is sort of broad, but like the right and wrong person for the field that you're working in? Like what kind of person works well in that environment?
I go first, Melissa, or
Go ahead.
So I think one of the worst people suited for medical laboratory science, specifically working in a hospital setting, some of the patients, is a dishonest person. So, a lot of what we do is very much unsupervised, and essentially, we're given a specimen. We're tasked with coming up with an independent, objective answer to some kind of a question. I think is one of the best ways to phrase it, doing tests. And it's possible for, bad actors to just make stuff up and just basically fabricate answers. And so those types of people, hopefully at the education level, we kind of try to weed out a bit. That's really, really hard to control for. I think, and I see where you're going too. So, like, the environment can be really stressful. And so I would say you have to have a minimum level of coping skills to deal with different stressors and things like that. I will say that you get better with how to cope with things, just being presented with those stresses too. And a lot of times you develop relationships in the lab setting with people that do this share those kind of stresses, and you're able to diffuse those emotions and stresses with those people that you work with. But yeah, I would say you need someone who's got some kind of moral compass that is governed by an agreed upon kind of set of basic, morals and ethics. So the ethics would be the work kind of rules that govern what's a good and bad thing to do in a lab. And then someone's got to be able to deal with stress at a base level, and at least have the capacity to diffuse those stressors, because they can kind of mount. So that would be like the ba that's a bad person for for med lab.
Well,
Melissa,
I
what do you
think
think?
too, like it's healthcare. So
Yeah.
a lot of
It's true.
the attributes you give to someone in healthcare, librarians need to have. And I would say even to some degree, the people skills, because librarians, one of the big things that we say as librarians is we don't have to see the patients ever. We don't have to look at them. We don't have to be near them. We don't have to touch them. That's why we want to be librarians, because we don't want to be with patients. But we still have to work with other librarians, physicians, nurses, anyone in the hospital we have to work with still. And so you still have to have some degree of people skills, even though we work in the lab and don't have to see patients. But I think to kind of build off of what Dave was saying, somebody who's honest is also going to be pretty reliable on time, because you need to be there to cover somebody else's shift if you're working in a hospital setting, which a lot of librarians do. Like, that's probably the most typical healthcare setting that people think of, is you're going to work in the lab in the somewhere in a hospital. But also self-driven, not necessarily that you have to be like me, where you go and you want to do a million things at once and you want to be, involved in everything. It doesn't have to be that self-driven, but you have to be self-driven to get your work done correctly, because a patient is on the other end of that lab results, and in a timely manner. And part of that will come down to somebody being trainable. So you really need to have somebody who's willing to take constructive criticism, willing to become better, willing to train and learn how to do the job and do it right, because that does help with the stress. Because when you're running an instrument and you're trying to do maintenance on another instrument and a doctor's screaming at you on the phone that they want the lab results, you have to know how to handle that sort of situation. And part of it is, if you're trained, well trained, you know how to run your instruments, you know how to do the maintenance, you've been trained on proper etiquette on the phone, all of that is going to be really beneficial. So yes, you have to deal with the stress, but part of it is, if you're trainable and you take in what your trainers tell you, then you're going to better be able to handle the stress of the job by having adequate training, or, even bare minimum, like learn how to do your job. That really significantly helps you being a good librarian.
So with that, I sort of, and all of the, this is good. I'm just pointing it out. You're, when I asked like what the requirements are, you gravitated towards very like, you need to be like emotionally there. You need to be able to handle the stress. You need to be trained for this stuff. What, it, so does that mean that, Like, what about academically? Like, do you, I noticed you didn't say anything like, oh, you need to be really good at this, or you need to be great at that. Is there not really academic requirements? Like, what's, you didn't bring that up. I thought that was interesting.
So there's a baseline, there's a floor of, I would say, college competency. Is that like a good way to say it, Melissa, I guess, to describe it? So different degree programs and accrediting accredited bodies will have different standards, so to speak. But generally speaking, at my in our ecosystem, we graduated C students, right? And I would trust those C students with my life and the livelihoods of my loved ones and everybody around me. Because generally speaking, the system is set up in such a way that as long as you're honest, that it'll all work out. Now, if you're like an A student, like I presume Melissa was, like I don't believe that. Is that helpful? Certainly. Yeah. So when you have a high skill ceiling, your opportunities in the laboratory are more expansive. So there'll be more different activities for you to kind of participate in. There'll be maybe higher complexity testing that'll be available to you. So it's definitely helpful, but I would say absolutely not required. If someone gets a C in chemistry and they want to work alongside me on the bench, I am happy to have them next to me. I really that's doesn't even cross my mind. Do we talk about competency in the laboratory? And do we look at some people and the stuff they're doing and like, yikes, right? That happens, but I'll tell you, I don't think it was ever really like something went wrong in college. What I'll tell you and expose to you is that competency and skill can atrophy. So, Josh, do you know what atrophy means?
Like a decay.
Yeah, very, yep. So, like, a muscle, you don't use that muscle, you lose it. Man, the brain is like that. Man, skills, problem solving, that stuff is like that. So, I think most of the time when we run into competency issues, it's not someone who just graduated from college. It's usually someone who's been around for a little while and they're not keeping up with their skills and competency. And so there's this massive drop off. So competency is definitely an issue, but I would say like a new grad that barely graduated is more than capable and competent to work in the lab. I think we do a good job of where the base, the floor is for our profession is pretty darn high, if that makes sense.
So I think too, we need to take a half a step back and just talk about education to get into our profession. So you have to either get an associate's degree in medical lab technology. So it's a 2 or 3 year program for an MLT to get your associate degree as an MLT. Or you can do a 4 year bachelor degree in medical lab science. And then you'd be an MLS. So MLS is a 4 year, MLT is a 2 year. That's the distinguishing features between the people who work in the laboratory. For either of them, when you graduate, you need to sit for a national certification exam. And so in order to the if you go through a program that's accredited nationwide for laboratory sciences. So it's called NACLS. They are the certifying agency for schools who teach MLT or MLS. If you go through a NACLS accredited program, then as soon as you graduate, you're eligible to sit for that national certification exam. And schools are required to put on their website whether they're NACLS accredited. And if they are NACLS accredited, then they're required to share with you their graduation rate, the attrition rate, which is the students that actually leave the program, that started the program and leave the program. And then they're also required to share with you their pass rate on the national certification exam so that you can see over the last 3 years, this program, they graduated X number of people, and of that, this percentage passed the certification exam. So that is all required to come into our profession. So, in part, That's why Dave and I never initially said you have to have this education, because we were already thinking about, well, you're already in the lab, so these are the features that you need to have. But if you go through a program, an MLT or MLS program, and sit for the national certification exam, then you have the base knowledge that you need to work in the laboratory for the position. So usually you have to be an MLS in order to be a lead tech, a senior tech, somebody in charge, somebody who has some sort of, I don't want to say power and authority, but you know that they're in charge of something. Whereas the MLTs are typically the ones running the lab, the actual laboratory tests. MLSs do as well, but MLSs typically move up, become a senior, a supervisor, and so on. So it just depends on where you are. If you work in a, there are some states that require licensure as well. So like Florida, California, they require a license to work in the lab. And in order to get your license, you have to pass the national certification exam and submit your certificate. So it just depends on the state that you work in. But we didn't initially say it because we assumed you went through a program and now you're working in the lab. So we do have those base programs that people have to go through to work in the lab. And if someone's interested in finding an MLS or an MLT program, they could go to naacls.org, NACLS.org, and put in their state or whatever state they want to go to. And then they could find an accredited program in that state.
Yeah, so once you're there, you're kind of good. It's just getting there. That's the hard
Correct.
So a lot of like what you guys do sounds very like obviously, well, okay, a lot of it, like the large bulk of it sounds very methodical. Like, okay, so if this thing is off, then it's this. And if that's off, it's that. It's obviously there's a lot of things for you to know. I'm not saying it's like easy. There's a lot of stuff. But and then you know sort of the hard parts are like those edge cases where it's like, oh, like what the hell's going on here? Why are all these things off? That's sort of the vibe I'm getting. As you know, like technology, especially AI, but just in general, becomes more of a thing. How realistic do you think it is that that's replaceable? Are you worried about that? Why or not?
So as long, so I'm getting a little old here. I'm not super old yet, but I'm getting a little old. So in the 10 years or so, have I been 10 years now? Yeah, something like that. So 10, 11 years, I've been a medical lab professional. They've been saying that they're going to automate all of our jobs away. And I sit here before you now, and we have a staff shortage nationwide that is a chasm. We're desperate for people to do these jobs. So what has happened historically is that as you automate more functions, what that allows the laboratory to do is to have higher throughput. So if we kind of look at things from like a productivity point of view, which is how the lab ends up kind of being viewed, the lab makes money for hospitals and institutions typically, is they say, hey, you know, Dave doesn't need to work as many hours to get this particular test done. What else can I do with Dave? And they always find a thing to do with Dave. So, yeah, right. So I think on some level, there is a pot of gold at the end of the automation rainbow. So at some point where general artificial intelligence is so sophisticated that it replaces just about every other thing we do. Can it happen? Yes, I think absolutely. But so far, and I think this trend will generally continue, automation has just made it so that we're able to do other things. It frees us up to do other stuff. Great question. But yeah, so I think maybe eventually, I don't know if we're going to see, I'm going to be 40 next month. I don't know if I will see artificial general intelligence that is fully, you know, come to fruition. But I think at some point, all jobs will probably disappear into the ether, and we'll be on that pile as well. But until we get to that holy explosion of general intelligence, for now, I think they're gonna keep finding stuff for us to do, right, Melissa?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be stuff for us to do. So let me give you an example. I disagree a little bit, Dave, because I feel like AI has already been in the lab for a while with machine learning and like automated differentials.
Oh, you're 100% right. Yeah,
So,
no. But I think when I'm talking about general intelligence, I'm talking about the singularity.
like Ultron type
I
stuff.
don't think
Yeah.
I don't think it would ever be able to really take over. And this example highlights why. So even with machine learning, right? So one of the things that I just mentioned was automated differentials. And so basically what we do is Dave and I have always worked in hematology. So when you think of med lab science, there's four major subdisciplines. There's clinical chemistry, which deals with like testing for like glucose, for I didn't okay. For like diabetes, things like that, hormone levels. And then there's hematology, which deals mostly with blood cells. So looking at cells and identifying anemias and leukemias and blood cancers. There's microbiology, which deals with finding like different organisms that cause infection and then what antibiotics are going to work best to treat those infections. And one of the big things that we have to do in micro is identify normal from abnormal. Because there's a lot of normal bacteria that we have on our bodies, and we have to make sure, is it the normal bacteria or is it abnormal? Or is it the normal bacteria abnormally taking over? So there's a lot of things it can be. And then the last major subdiscipline is blood bank. So that's basically where you've probably heard people talk about, like, I'm B positive, I'm O negative for like blood types. So blood bank does the blood typing, but they're also the ones that check all of the blood to make sure that it's safe for being transfused or put into a person. So cancer patients need blood. Patients who have severe anemias like sickle cell disease need regular blood transfusion. So those sorts of things. Blood bank is responsible for all the testing and then making sure that it's the right blood product for the right patient. So those are the major subdisciplines. So if you come to hematology, which is where Dave and I live, we look at blood cells a lot. And so if anybody ever looks at our channel on YouTube, it's really just looking at blood cells. That's basically what we do. We look at slides underneath a microscope. But there has been instrumentation available in the hematology lab for a very long time where the machine, the instrument, has learned how to identify cells to an extent. And so part of our job, not our job working in the lab, but the job of the hematologist who work for that company who creates these sorts of instruments is to teach the machines, teach the instruments how to identify the cells. But they're really, the instruments are really only good at normal, right? So the normal cells. Then you get to patients who have severe infections and the blood cells start to look a little wonky. You get to patients who have severe anemias and your bone marrow starts spitting out really immature cells and the instrumentation is not good at that. And then of course your cancer patients. So patients who have blood cancers, their cells look really, really weird, really abnormal, and the instrumentation can pick out that all of these cells are abnormal, but it can't place what it is. Why is it that? So it's our job to look at it and say, oh, this is normal and this is abnormal. So if the instrument's picking out the abnormal cells, we're the ones distinguishing, are these truly abnormal or are they actually normal for the patient, for what's happening? So yes, AI will play a role in the laboratory. It's going to play a role everywhere, like Dave said. But I don't think it's ever going to take over the lab because you still need that interpretive aspect. And I don't know that AI is ever going to be able to go all the way into abnormal because when you look at cancer, cancer looks different for everybody. Like when you look at a patient, you just see a patient with cancer. But when we look at the cells, like each cell looks completely different from one patient to the next patient, even if they have the same cancer. So part of the job is interpreting and identifying that it's abnormal so that the physicians can then do further testing to identify what cancer is this, what is going on. So I don't know that AI will ever actually take over because of the interpretive aspect that we need to have.
So really, sort of, I never even thought about that. Because if you're trying to train an AI to recognize something abnormal, the whole point of the way AI works is that you give it data and then it recognizes that. So if you can't train it on, by definition, something that's inherently different, it's really interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, and
Yeah.
I don't think we're anywhere near general intelligence. So I think you're good for now, AGI. I think we're good.
Well, just to go back, I said I'm 40. I don't know if I'll live to see the day. But because I'm so lazy, I secretly just want the cold embrace of artificial intelligence to take over all the drudgery of work so I can continue to be lazy into infinity.
But we want it to take over the parts and not the fun parts, right? So we want it to take over the quality control and the calibration and not take over looking at cells because that's the fun part.
Well, it can do all that too, as long as I get. You can see who's the lazy bum in the two of us, and yeah. But yes, yeah. Great questions. Great questions.
I kind of forgot to think of it. My whole strategy was thinking of a question while you're answering it, but I forgot to that time.
Yeah, no
I
worries.
was too enveloped in what was
No,
going
we
on.
appreciate that. But yeah, AI has really creeped into the lab in a lot of different ways. And it started out as like little things. So computers really helped us kind of make decisions. So thinking about we use middleware. So we use software that results land before they go to their final destination. We'll say that. So that's where the term middleware comes from. And the middleware can do like interesting things to highlight values that are out of range, and then a recommended action that would be prudent to follow up. And that makes us have to like think less, right? So we call them operator alerts, and they have a bunch of if-then statements sort of in them.
It helps to
And
standardize what's happening in the
100%.
procedures, which you need to have the standardization in the lab. We're all about procedures, following the procedure, having things outlined for us, if you couldn't tell. So that's why we like to have to use, we kind of build the rules into the software.
So that's the irony, actually, is that we're as organic beings that are flawed. Our goal in the laboratory is to be as automaton robotic in our thinking and application, even technical, like using our hands, to be as robotic and reproducible as possible. So every testing system has variables beyond control that introduce something we call random error, and we're trying to minimize the human piece of that as much as possible. So SOPs. Standard operating procedure. It's very important. Robots.
You guys just have like a basic, sort of broad, like a day in the life sort of perspective you can give me what a work day is like.
Yeah, I can give you a general idea. So, if shift starts, so I had like a really, really cool like split shift. And I might be starting at like 1 p.m. or something like that, right? So I'm gonna show up at 12:45, and I come in, you walk through the lab, you say, "Hey, what's up?" You say hello to everybody. You go and you put your stuff away, and then you walk by the schedule. So the schedule is the ruler of my universe. I look at the schedule, I look at the day, and I see what I'm assigned to do. And then I walk over to my assigned area. So generally the laboratory is cut up into different big umbrellas. So Melissa talked about blood bankers versus microbiologists versus hematologists. And then those individual areas are cut up into what we would call like workbenches. So depending on the types of work that a lab does, a bench could do different functions. Maybe we had one place that we called odds and ends. And so there's a bunch of small tests that don't have like a good home, and like the volume of those tests might be low. So we just say, hey, this one person can do all of those tests as needed. So workbenches can vary. Sometimes a lot of times a workbench is like this particular machine doing this very particular testing, this is what you'll be on. So I check the schedule, go to my assigned bench, and there would be someone operating that bench. So the hospital we worked at is running 24/7, 365, right? So there's always a person or people, lots of people running the lab. And they would give me what we'd call messages. So simply, we put, they might tell me, hey, this machine's been doing this dumb thing, right? These, the operating room and emergency room have been like, oh, today, So they're going to give me a heads up about things that may be relevant for me to make decisions going forward so that people aren't blind. And then you kind of work that bench, work that area. And like, depending on the shift, might be a little bit slow. Maybe you goof around and you're on the internet a little bit while stuff is running. So, like, just being real, right? This is the way it goes. And sometimes it's lights out and you're just buried and you're doing the work. I personally like to be buried. My day, when my day goes by fast, it's almost always because I'm busy doing things. And so typically at the beginning of a shift, it depends on the laboratory and everything. We would run something called quality control. So quality control is a process by which we use material that we know the answers to the tests ahead of time, and we're blind testing the instrument. So I expect for my low control to get a value of 2 to 3, whatever that test is, right? I'm just using arbitrary numbers. If the instrument gives me a 2.5, that's within the range. I'm like, cool. So this thing is working and appropriately and independently coming up with the answer. And so I've controlled the quality. The quality control has passed. So we usually do that like once a shift. Sometimes it's in the beginning of the shift. Sometimes it's in the middle of the shift. It sort of depends on laboratory workflow, staffing, all that stuff. Depending on your shift and what's going on, you might have particular maintenances that you have to do on the instruments. So a lot of these instruments have really complicated components that need to be cleaned, or sometimes things need to be lubricated, or you have to maintain the instrument, and there'll be like weekly, daily, monthly, even types of maintenance that you might perform. Depending on the types of testing you might do, you might have to do something called calibration. So calibration is separate from maintaining and separate from quality control, in that when you calibrate an instrument, you're reminding it, like, this is what a 2 looks like, right? So it performs a particular function, and then all these instruments see is electrons in bits and bytes. So you need to tell it, hey, this physiological variable is linked to this many bits, bytes, and electrons, right? So that's essentially what a calibration is, more or less. And then usually, hopefully, if you're in a lab, you'll have a different bench later on in the day. So I liked that where we worked, you might work in like 2 to 3 different places throughout the whole day. Couple of benefits to that. Number one, it breaks up the monotony a little bit of the day. And number two, it maintains your competency pretty well, just without any like messing around. Like the fact that you will rotate through all the different work areas like 3 or 4 times total throughout the entire week is like really, really helpful in maintaining competency in a given area.
Hey Dave, what
Yeah.
is competency? You've said it a couple of times, but what
Hey,
does that mean?
competency. So generally speaking, we have so we talked about accredited words. We talked about accrediting agencies for education. Well, we have independent bodies that certify that a laboratory is accredited and expected by a particular body. So one of the drivers for quality workforce in the laboratory are these competency assessments from third parties that then lead to institutions having their own competency-based system. So what the heck is that? Well, if so me as like a more senior level tech, I might handle the competency for differentials, we'll say. We talked a little bit about cells. So cells are morphological pattern recognition, right? So I see certain patterns and colors, and I then know it's a particular cell. So I might take slides that my coworkers don't know what they are and say, tell me what the answer is, right? And so if they're able to do so within, whatever agreed upon kind of min-maxes, then they would be deemed competent, right? And so we would do internal competency like that. And then the external competency piece would be these third-party accrediting bodies. I'm probably using the wrong term. Melissa will correct me eventually. These third parties will send us unknowns that the whole lab has no idea what the heck is in there. And we're to treat it as though it's a patient sample. So that would mean that we're not just picking Melissa, the smartest cookie in the room, to always do the competency checks. We don't want to do that. We want it to be somewhat random and representative of the whole lab. But the idea is that they know the answer and we don't. We take that specimen, that unknown, and then we work it up like we would normally, come up with an answer and then submit it to them. And they say yes, or they say, you got it wrong. Right? Geez. So if we get it wrong, we usually have to write a report about why we messed up and say we're really super duper sorry. And then there'll usually be follow-up competency where you really better get the right answer there. I've personally never been in a situation where we goof up two in a row. I mean, that just does not happen. And even still, like goofing up one, sometimes there's even a bit of controversy about what the correct answer might even be. There might be some debate there too. So, yeah, that, I don't know, Melissa, does that sound about right?
Yes, but we can summarize it and say basically you have to take a test every year.
Yeah.
So
Yep.
there's both written and hands-on tests that you have to do. So Dave was talking more about like the hands-on tests we have to do yearly to make sure that we can do the testing physically, but there's also a written test that goes with it to make sure that we can think through the problems and get the right answer. So same thing. And it's both internal and external, both hands-on and written.
Everybody hates competency,
Yeah.
right? Because it's tedious. It takes you off of what you're doing, but it
Yes.
is one of the essential components to
Yes.
maintaining a self-help, a safe, excuse me, a healthcare environment for
So
sure.
the quizzes never go away. You get out of college
Cool.
and then you still take them every year in the but it is essential for maintaining, making sure that we can actually do the work and do it well and get the right answer because that is important because we're again looking at patient specimens and trying to get the right answer. So Dave,
Yeah.
if you don't mind, just a the day in the life for a librarian, it'll really depend on the lab you work in,
Oh, 100%.
the shift that you work. So when we say shifts, there could be somewhere in the day shift. Day shift is usually 7 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., but it could vary slightly depending on where you work. Evening shift is usually 2:30 or 3 to 11 or 11:30, and then night shift is usually 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. And then, of course, there's split shifts, like Dave was saying. And then it just depends. So the hospital environment is great because you have the option to work these shifts. And if you work night shift, you're a lot more independent because there's no managers, there's no supervisors. It could be just you, depending on the lab you work in, if you work in a very
It's the
small
wild
lab.
shift.
Yes. And if you work in a lot like the lab we worked in, there was three people in the hematology lab alone for night shift. So like there was other people around. So it just depended on where you work for that, if you're alone or if you have other people. So it depends on the shift you work, the experience you're going to have. Like I said, you're a lot more reliant on yourself overnights than you are day shift. Evening shift as well, but if you have a question, evening shift. If it's like 7 o'clock at night, you could always call your supervisor at home. If it's 2 in the morning, do you really want to call your supervisor? Sometimes you can, depending on the location. My husband's been on call before and he's gotten calls at, 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, whatever. So it depends on where you work for that. But night shift is usually a lot more, you're a lot more independent. And then it depends if you work in a facility where, like Dave and I, we were in hematology only. We worked in different benches in hematology, like he was saying. But if you work in a smaller hospital, you're typically going to work in multiple areas. So you might work in hematology and chemistry, and then you might plant specimens for micro, which is basically setting them up so that when day shift comes in, then they can read them, kind of thing. They can look at them and start interpreting them. Or you might just work in blood bank micro. So if you work in a smaller facility, you're going to work in more areas, but it's going to be less specialized. So you're going to be doing more of the routine blood work. And what we mean by routine would be like when you go to the doctors, you usually get like a yellow top and a purple top drawn. And so you're usually getting like 10 basic chem tests done and then a CBC. That's routine work. Right. Everywhere is going, almost every lab's going to offer that sort of testing. Whereas when you go to like the bigger facilities, they're going to have more specialized testing. And so the labs get more specialized and people have to branch off and work in more specialized locations. A lot of students graduate and think I want to work as a generalist, meaning in all of the areas before I go to one area. Or sometimes students graduate and they're like, nope, I only want to work in hematology. So it just depends on the student's preferences. So that will also kind of dictate how your day goes. So Dave, in my perspective, is very unique and it's very similar because we've worked at the same place in the hematology lab on all shifts basically at one point or another. And then you might work, like for example, where we worked, we both worked in the routine area. So basic hematology that was open 24/7 all the time, holidays, whenever. And then we also worked in special areas. So my specialty is bleeding and clotting. So I used to work in the lab that tested for bleeding and clotting disorders. And that lab was Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 sort of hours. And then sometimes I would get called in or have to work different hours if I knew a particular patient was going to be in-house or we had an emergency come in and we had a particular patient need testing in order to get the proper care, then I would have to go in for that sort of thing. And Dave specialized in hemoglobin testing. So looking at the different types of hemoglobin. And again, a Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 sort of laboratory section, except for again, when you have those rare patients that come in that need to have a value done in order to get the proper treatment. So again, it just depends on where you work. When we're in the specialty areas, you're working by yourself and it's a lot more intense and you need a lot more of the theory you learned in college. And when you're working in the routine area, it's very structured. It's very operator alerts. The instrument is very helpful to you. So it just depends on the area you work, the hospital you work, the shift you work, the areas that you work, what your day in the life will be.
It can vary a lot.
Yes, it's a huge variety,
Yeah, we
which
forgot
is
lunch
nice.
breaks and dinner breaks and the
Yeah, we get
normal
those
work stuff.
sometimes.
No eating.
Well, most of the time we did get those. There would be the occasional day that I did not get those, but typically there are lunch breaks and that'll vary by place
Pretty
as
sure that's
well.
illegal, but yeah.
Well, no, you just put in when your time clock, you would say, I didn't get a lunch today. You're supposed to get a lunch, but depending on your day, it happened a couple times where it was just a bad day, you know. That's when you start having problems and troubleshooting, and that's when you're getting to more advanced stuff than just routine running your bench. If you're routine running your bench, you're always going to get a break. Don't worry about that.
Good. So, specifically, thinking about college, like a lot of, from what I've heard from a lot of people, and just looking at even like just like data, it's extremely common to change your mind a lot when you're in college. So, for you guys personally, when you went into college, were you like sure? Were you just thinking like, oh yeah, I want to be doing this for sure. I want to be a hematologist, or were you like, oh, I kind of something biology related, or were you just completely had no idea?
First, Melissa, or
Sure. So, when I went for my undergrad, my mother told me I was going to be a concert violinist. So I started college as a music major. I was actually music ed because I told I don't like to I play I don't like to play in front of people. So I don't know how she ever thought I was going to be a concert violinist, but
that's
okay.
kind of an issue.
Yes, but I taught violin, I taught cello all throughout high school and in college a little bit. So my first year I was a music major and I hated it. What I really wanted to do actually was marine biology. I loved marine biology. The summer after I graduated high school, I did a summer trip to Bermuda, the biological station for research, and I had a blast there with the biology teacher and a couple other students from my high school. I really wanted to be marine bio. So the summer after I was a music major, I was like, I'm done with music. I'm switching. My mom was furious, but I was like, I'm switching. I'm not doing this again. And so I went to bio and I was like, I need to switch into bio. And they were like, we're not talking to anybody transferring until like September. And I was like, oh no, I'm not starting the semester as a music major. So I went and met with the department heads from chemistry, physics. I don't even like physics, but I went to like every other science possible and I saw med lab science and I was like, I don't know what this is, but I need to get out of music. So I met with the department head. Basically, I was meeting with them all and being like, okay, what am I going to do with chemistry? What am I going to do in physics? What am I going to do with these things? So I met with the department head and I will never forget. He walked into the meeting and it was the midsummer. He walked in jeans, a t-shirt that was covered in paint spots and his hair was sticking up in like funny angles. And he's like, I'm just painting my house, sorry. And I actually got really dressed up because I was thinking like, this is an important interview to get into his department, maybe sort of thing. It was really funny. So I went in and I was like, all right, what is med lab science? And he was basically like, okay, it's biology, chemistry, anatomy and physiology all mixed together and applied to humans and human healthcare. But the nice thing about it is you don't have to see the patients, you don't have to touch the patients. If you want to do phlebotomy, like if you want to be doing that, and some hospitals will have the laboratorians doing that, especially in the more rural areas, then you might be doing phlebotomy. But for the most part, our role is laboratory testing and helping interpret. And you really do help interpret in the specialty areas a lot. You work with physicians so that they understand what does my lab test mean, because they only get a couple hours of laboratory testing in med school and we get years of it. So we do help explain laboratory tests and what is this lab test for? What does it mean, that especially in the specialty areas? So I talked to him and he basically sold me on it. And I was like, all right, I'm switching to med lab. And so I switched to med lab, but I will say, even so, I was like, well, maybe I want to be a chemistry teacher, like Gen Chem in high school while I was in med lab science. So summer to senior year for med lab science, I did an intern, a STEM internship teaching marine biology at CLAB, which is a small summer school that focuses on marine biology for like fifth graders through like ninth graders. So I did an internship there and I did it at the Ocean Explorium, which has since closed, but was really cool. It was basically a small aquarium that also had science on a sphere. And I used to give lectures using science on a sphere. Yes, I was in college doing this and it was like the best thing ever. I would still be doing it if I could because it was so much fun. But so I did that and I actually worked there part-time the first year after I graduated. And I thought, well, maybe I just want to teach chemistry. So there's a, each state has their own like licensure for teaching like high school and stuff. So I took the English portion of the Massachusetts licensure exam. And then when I graduated, I could have taken this chemistry one or whatever. And my boyfriend at the time, now husband, my boyfriend was like, what's wrong with you? You're getting a degree in med lab science. Go work in a lab. So I did my internship because you have to do an internship as part of an ACLS accredited MLS program. And so I did my internship where I ended up working. And I hated the commute because I am not a city person whatsoever, but I loved the institution that I worked at. And so I did my internship for the 3 months that I was there and I loved it. And they offered me a job and I ended up doing that and never going back to teach high school. But here I am now teaching at the college level. But yeah, that so I started out as a music major, ended up with med lab science. That's my
I mean,
story.
it's
So
a little bit of the opposite of like the stereotype, forced into music by your parents and then going into science.
it's, yes, it's very unusual, I know. And the funny thing is when I switched my major, my mom told me, you're never gonna get a job. And I was like, what's wrong with you?
Why did she think concert violinist was like a majorly successful position?
Well, so she wanted to be an artist. I know she wanted to be an artist when she was in high school, but then she ended up getting pregnant and having my brother. So she couldn't go to college for art. So she really wanted me to go for art. I mean, I can't do art to save my life. So I think music was the art she wanted me to go for and live
Like the compromise,
vicariously through me. But I can still play my violin. I just don't want to play in front of people. Dave.
So I had like a weird kind of path, I guess, but I worked in manufacturing industry for a little while. The company I worked for made windows, and I stocked the parts on the shelf for them to make the windows with. That was what I did. And during the 2008 financial crisis, I lost my job, and I had very little resume experience, right? So on resume, I was like really weak because I hadn't been doing the work for particularly wrong. So I wasn't very competitive. Simultaneously, my mother had become very, very ill. And the clinical team that was taking care of her, I was sort of the family liaison to kind of communicate with them and kind of figure out what was going on. So I bought a textbook to read to be able to communicate with them. She had an infection at the time, so it was microbiology oriented. And I just kind of learned that I had a knack for this stuff. And I never actually even considered the biological sciences, chemistry at all. So I took a really, really weird path to get to where I'm at. And so I looked up microbiology. I literally Googled it, and Jim Griffith's face came up. Oh, geez. And Jim, I presume, is the individual that Melissa was talking about with the paint stains. And I'm just laughing. The guy has more charisma than combined with the rest of the university instructors. Honestly, he usually captures a room
He's
when he
got more
speaks.
charisma in his pinky nail than Dave and I combined.
Yeah, I mean, he really is he's so funny and
Yeah,
witty,
he's
kind of a
amazing. Yeah.
dry kind of tone guy, but yeah, super funny. So his beautiful mug showed up in Google. And then yeah, I applied, and I got declined admission. They said you don't have the background. So I begged, and so they let me take the freshman year classes under like a provisional thing, acceptance, right? Like if you do well, we'll let you in. But if you mess this up, see you later. And and that's kind of how I got into it. So I kind of experienced a piece of the working life that I didn't like, this 9 to 5 manufacturing company kind of grinds, doing like business work, whatever the hell, and I absolutely hated it. And then here was this thing that for some reason I was really good at, but didn't discover until way later in life. So that's where. So I was an older student. So I think I was like 26 or 27 going into my undergrad. And I think that that's really helpful because I do think like 18, 19, 20 years old, starting an undergraduate career, it's so hard to know what you want to do. It really is. You're going to have a lot of really cool experiences, a lot of really bad experiences. And you're going to think you're going to want to go one way, but I would say keep your options open, and just be a sponge. Talk to your friends and whoever about what they're doing and figure it out. Because the first year or so, you really do have a ton of flexibility, I think, being able to kind of bounce around. So I think it's very common for people to switch majors, and that's good. I don't think that's a bad thing at all, to be honest. For me, it was just a little bit different because I got to try a bunch of crap I hated first in different ways to find my path. But yeah.
But I think most, not all, obviously, but most of the students in MedLab found it on accident.
Yeah,
They
100%.
can't because they didn't have like a video like this or something to look at and say MedLab science. And also they didn't look it up and be like MedLab science because people don't usually know what MedLab science is. So, if we can get MedLab science out there and let people know more of what it is, and then I think people would look at it earlier rather than, for purposes like Dave or I found it on accident.
It's unfortunate.
Did that in high school, Dave, did anything did you feel any sort of connection or ambition for biology or anything? Or was it just nothing until later in life when you found it?
Ambition, that is a word that missed me. I'll tell you that much. In high school, I was a goof off. I mean, I barely graduated high school, and basically by design. I was a pretty bright student when I was younger, very enthusiastic, and the light left me at some point. and high school on, it just was a mess. So, I didn't try. I just tried. What I was trying to do, if anything, in high school is find the easiest path to just get through it and get to the other side. And in hindsight, it's absolutely poor use of my time. But at some point I course corrected. So
Worked
that's the
out.
boring piece.
So, as like somebody who's, let's say somebody who's, listening to this and is like, this is what they want to go into. Maybe they're like just graduating high school. Maybe they're like a bit into college. They want to change course or something. Like, they're considering it, but they're not sure. Like, what do you have to say to them? Like, what is your final advice or like word of warning or whatever?
What do you think, Melissa? You want to go first, or I'll go first?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you can do is find a laboratorian, find someone and go shadow them. Go into the lab and spend a day with them and see what it is that they do. Usually hospitals will allow that, especially now that COVID is, we're past the craziness of it. So they allowed it before and they're still allow, a lot of them will still allow that. So I would say find a laboratorian and actually go spend a day and see if that's really something that you're interested in. Also, if you find an MLS or an MLT program, then reach out to them and see, maybe you want to go in full acceptance and, get into the program and start, or maybe you want to take a class and see, is this something that I actually like? Depending on the program that you go into, what class you're starting with, but typically you're going to find out pretty quickly that this is something that you can or can't do. I've had students shadow me before when, Dave and I were working at the hospital we worked at together. I was the educational liaison, so I would have high school students following me all the time. I had high school students, medical interns, residents, everybody, all the students basically. If they were a student of some kind, they were mine in the lab. And I used to have high school students come in all the time. And I had one girl look at me and be like, I'm going to pass out. And I was like, you can't get a job in the lab then because you look at blood and you want to pass out. Okay, so I think that those are important pieces to know, and you're not going to know unless you get near blood. I mean, maybe you already know. If you do, then no, don't go into med lab. But if that's something, like, go and shadow. That's where you're going to find it out, or take a class. So I think that's the biggest thing is try it. Go and explore and see. And if you can't find somebody, if you're really interested, reach out to Dave and I. We have contacts all over the United States, and we can help you get in touch with somebody who's local to you if you have a hard time finding someone.
Say, even if you are a little bit squeamish around blood, you can be desensitized to it. Because I remember initially I was apprehensive about the gross stuff, and at some point you're just dead to it. It might be a harder path for some folks than others to get there, but there's a point to which you see a person's like skull in a container and like you don't care, like you just stop caring about the severed finger or a toe. It can get pretty gruesome. You kind of become desensitized to it. I would say if someone is thinking about like career choices and things like that, one of the things I would highlight from med lab, I always look at things as to what do I have to invest in something and what do I get back? Right. So, return on investment for an undergrad degree, there's not much better. There are, I would say an undergraduate engineering degree is pretty fruitful.
Nursing.
But undergraduate BSN, Bachelor of Science in Nursing, yep, that's pretty darn fruitful. But geez, like I think once I go through some of those top ones, there's not much better than med lab, to be honest. I have colleagues and friends with undergraduate degrees making well into the six figures with just their bachelor's degree. And that's really hard to replicate in other professions. So there's a lot of money to be made doing this stuff.
Not as educators. But in industry, there is.
Yeah, I get paid. I'm like super mega underpaid. But yeah, I think it, you know, and you know, like what kind of aptitudes? Well, like, you know, if you don't like wince completely in chemistry, this might be good for you. If like biology courses, whatever, like you were good with that, this might be good for you. And then even if not, even if those are things that like are they taste bad, but you can do them, this might be good for you. But yeah, it's I would also say that the coolest thing about the work, this applies to my teaching a little bit too, is that it, given who I am, I'm motivated by the work. So for me, I always maintained a deep connection to the patient. So when I'm on the bench, I care a lot about the work I'm doing because I care about making a difference. And I'm not gonna lie, day to day, you don't always make a difference. You just don't. You're pushing buttons and validating stuff. But every now and then, you do something that's really special that really impacts the patient's life in a positive way. And those things can carry me for months, right? I'll never forget the first pediatric patient that I helped diagnose with leukemia. That was very, very impactful. It echoes with me today. I always tell this story, but seeing that individual's name subsequently, year after year, and then being like healthy, and to know I was a part of that whole thing is really, really special. And it doesn't matter how much I get paid, that's going to be a highlight. Teaching, so on the teaching side, I really get a lot, it's really rewarding to me to teach and to see the light in students. And I love teaching people that are smarter than me. There's so many of them. So many really, really bright kids, and it's absolutely magic. So I think med lab can be really good for some people if those things kind of resonate with you. So, because the thing I will tell younger folks now is like, you got to get up every day and go to work. And that sucks. If you have something about the work you're doing that makes it suck less, you need to lean into that. And so I think med lab's cool and that it has that piece to it. And that's been good for me. And I think it could be good for other people.
And again, if you want
Yeah.
to work in healthcare, but you don't want to see the patients, that's what we do.
Yeah, I love being helpful, but they smell bad and or you know, whatever. And
They don't
you
listen.
know,
I don't want to touch them.
and they're mean to me and like all those other things. Yeah, so that's a nice piece too. But
Yes.
I think it's me that actually smells bad. It's really hot in here.
Yeah.
Josh, thanks so much.
Yes,
This
thank you.
was, I mean, you crushed it, my friend. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So are we good there, Melissa? What do you think?
I think we're pretty good. Yeah. So, Josh, thank you for your time and questions, and everybody else, thanks for watching.
Yeah, take care.